Aloha and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and hello there to you.
Chris. Hi, Beth Ann.
Good to see you.
Hey, contrary to what you might have heard, there is such a thing as climate change.
Well, and that's exactly the point of many a scientist.
Yeah.
And as you know, the current and expected impacts of climate change in the U.S. are documented in a report issued every 4 years under a congressional mandate. The next National Climate Assessment is due next year, and the federal and non-federal authors are now at work. How they'll be able to continue their research in a changed political climate has many of them concerned, and yet perhaps even more committed to the science they say is settled. A boon may be that the federal policy across agencies will likely take longer to change. Meanwhile, researchers will be releasing information even between the formal national climate assessments. Victoria Keener is a research fellow at the East-West Center, and she's the lead author for the Hawaii and Pacific Islands chapter of the current fourth national climate assessment. Welcome to the program. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
When you talk to many of your fellow scientists now, what is the sense that you're getting from them, you know, this moment that may be a little different from what we heard from them after the election and even after the inauguration?
I do think that everyone's on edge. We're paying a lot of attention. A lot of the information coming out isn't very clear, but in terms of the political climate and the future of a lot of the research that we're doing, but everyone is very committed, spending more time, volunteering more time to really get products like the National Climate Assessment out and make sure their quality research and adaptation work coming out.
And we should make the point that that is all based on volunteer, at least for the non-federal employees.
Right,
efforts.
Right. So the National Climate Assessment, which you said comes out every 4 years, is mandated by law, but there are federal and non-federal authors involved, and all of the regional authors, including the team in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands, are all volunteering their time to make this happen. So it's kind of a second full-time job for a lot of people.
That said, does that also mean that it makes it in some ways easier to get information out between the assessments, given that that seems to be where a lot of scientists have been going, to make sure that there's a constant stream and not just, you know, a big blip every 4 years?
Exactly. So the National Climate Assessment is very important on that national and federal scale at really educating the public, educating policymakers, people who manage natural resources. But where the decisions really get made are at the state and regional level. So policies dictating exactly how cities are adapting and responding to climate change impacts are made at that state level and that regional level. So what we're doing with the regional climate assessments and the products in between that we're calling the sustained assessment is really trying to build a structure that operates at that regional and state level in Hawaii and the affiliated islands. So we're operating independently and can get research and adaptation work out in between those four-year blips.
And how is that squaring with a lot of the federal agencies that now are having to, in some ways, perhaps reinvent themselves to continue work that they've been doing for a very long time, or perhaps are being reinvented without some of that work being put out in ways that we have seen traditionally, as we saw, you know, even earlier this year with the EPA website down and not a lot of information coming from them, not coming through Twitter, not coming through Facebook.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a federal scientist, but there, like I said, there's so much uncertainty and we just don't know how it's going to play out at this point. But from my colleagues in federal agencies, you know, that they are just as committed to getting this work out. The National Climate Assessment is not hiding what they're doing. You know, it's a law. It's a federal law to happen every 4 years, and we're going forward with you know, a thorough and comprehensive assessment of the risks to different sectors. So the ones that we're really concentrating on this time around in our region, different regions concentrate on different sectors depending on what people have been most interested in. So this time around, we're looking at climate risks and freshwater resources, ecosystems and biodiversity, indigenous communities, oceans, marine ecosystems, and coastal structures, infrastructure, things like that. So taking that all together and looking at what are the key risks in those sectors and what are the key adaptations that we can take now moving forward, just realizing that the science is going to continue to evolve. We're always going to, you know, get more data, get better information, but it's getting warmer and the sea level is still rising. So we really have to start taking concrete steps now.
Your point seems to be that although that data will get better and you'll get more of it, it's pretty good right now. And so scientists don't want to wait.
Right. There's always a conversation about the levels of uncertainty that we're dealing with in projections and data. And of course, in every scientific assessment and everything in life, there's uncertainty. But really, it's about quantifying the uncertainty that we can understand and what we don't know, and acting on the best information that we have now. Because if you delay action until things are completely certain, the resource is going to be gone because there's never going to be complete certainty.
You mentioned a long shopping list of what you're looking at in our region. Can you unpack that a little bit so that people have a better idea of what exactly you're looking for within the Hawaii state and also the Pacific region?
Yeah, sure. So, for example, we want for freshwater resources, what are the impacts of increasing temperature, increasing evaporative demand, decreasing groundwater levels in Hawaii? What will that do to our public water supply? What will that do to our coastal wells as sea level rise continues to intrude at the coasts? You know, what happens to that line between saltwater and freshwater in our aquifers? What are the key risks in our infrastructure that will be impacted in the next 20 to 30 years that we can plan for? And at the end of the century. So the irony a lot of these climate models that we work with is that they get more certain the further out we get in time. So by the end of the century, we actually have a lot more certainty about average impacts than we do in 20 to 30 years, which is dominated by natural climate variability. But what we really want to know from the listeners, the public, anybody who's interested is what are the risks from climate change in Hawaii and the Pacific Islands that you perceive and that you're interested in learning how to adapt to. And so we have a town hall event tonight, actually, at 6 p.m. on the University of Hawaii campus in the Eamon Center. And it's open to the public. And we're going to have our lead authors for the chapter and a couple of speakers presenting on what we already know and what we really want to get from the public. And this is really a chance for people who care to come out and both let us know and let the federal government know what you're interested in.
And while tonight's meeting will be one shot at doing that, clearly this is going to be going on between now and forever, most likely, because a lot of scientists have just said that they're going to continue doing this, as you said, on a volunteer basis, as you put it, as their second job. Well, we wish you a lot of good luck with all the effort and energy that has to go into this. And a lot of people and a lot of other people, who are not necessarily engaged at the depth that you are counting on good information, and we hope that it still comes out.
Yeah, we want everybody to get involved.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Victoria Keener is a research fellow at the East-West Center in Honolulu. She's also the lead principal investigator of the NOAA-sponsored Pacific Regional Integrated Sciences and Assessments Program. She's the lead editor and a chapter author for the 2012 Pacific Islands Regional Climate Assessment Report and the lead author for the Hawaii and Pacific Islands chapter of the current 4th National Climate Assessment. If you want more information about tonight's meeting, take a look at our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a musical about a determined band of 80s rockers. But first, your quiz.
Ulehua, unihau, ukaua, oa, umulokai. ana o mau o kaho'olawe o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a native bird that darts and dives above the ocean surface. Its feeding patterns are a pleasure to watch. It preys on small fish that have been driven to the surface by predators, skimming along the surface or diving just below to gobble them up. It's a coastal seabird that ranges throughout Oceania, from Hawaii to New Zealand, and it can be found along coastlines as far-ranging as Indonesia and Brazil. It's small, with white plumage and a long black bill and a wingspan of about 25 inches. Its bill is thick and sharply pointed, with electric blue base, and no difference in plumage between adult males and females. Nesting pairs can stay together for years and often return to the same coastal nest site year after year. They don't build nests, though. They lay eggs wherever a suitable site can be found, ending up on tree branches, the sides of buildings, even on the ground. Today we're looking for their name, and if you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and you got it right, you'll get the prize.
Aloha. I'm Michael Clicks from Honeybee Management Services. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The rock and roll of the 1980s was all about flash and trash, over-the-top showmanship, plenty of Led Zeppelin-inspired bombast and pounding, amplified rhythm. But popular music is driven by trends, and the musical Rock of Ages is about what happens when a rock and roll nightclub is threatened with closure and its musicians, teased hair, spandex, and all, struggle to keep it going. Hannah Shawargali is the director of the Mono Valley Theater production that opens this weekend, and she's with us in our studio. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Your show has to really evoke an era with all its symbols, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Symbols being what?
Symbols being big hair, glam rock, the indulgence of the 80s.
Yeah. Everything kind of exaggerated to the maximum.
Yes, it was. I lived through it. I went to the concerts.
Uh-huh.
I'm watching it on stage being like, I'm supposed to be directing, but I just want to rock. So it's all about that kind of big, indulgent, uplifting. And yet this particular story is about the dreams we come in with.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when we change our dreams, and sometimes the dreams you come in with are not the ones you leave with.
That's a lot of subject for a musical, isn't it?
It is.
How does that manifest itself in the story?
Well, you have to have a love story. I'm stealing lines from the show because...
Okay. Feel free.
you have to have a love story. We have a love story. Sometimes what you think is going to happen doesn't always happen.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you come through it? I did this. I went there. I thought I was going to have that rock and roll thing, but I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But what I came up with was so much better than that.
So that's kind of the arc.
That's our arc for the show.
Trying to get one thing and ending up with something better?
Right, yeah. Coming in with a big eye open and going, I'm going to take this.
Yeah.
And then going, oh, wait, maybe I want that instead. But it's full of all of the 80s rock and roll music, big concert pieces,
mm-hmm.
All of that, and love stories you didn't know were going to happen.
I like the way you said that, Hannah. It sort of added a layer of intrigue to the whole thing, didn't
All
it?
All right.
When you were experiencing 80s rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
what was different about it to you? You know, was it just what made it hit you in ways that the earlier music hadn't? Just the the hugeness of it all?
Can I tell a mom story?
Please.
So in the 80s, my mom actually took me to a Guns N' Roses concert.
Good wholesome entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because she didn't really appreciate the music, of course, even though I was listening to it in my room like every day on like great volume.
Right.
But she was like, Axl Rose is a genius.
Really?
And I was like, okay. And I went with my sisters and I went with my brother and we did all of these concerts together. And so kind of living through that, the floor shaking underneath you,
right,
the lights hitting you in the eye, that big look.
Yeah. Even the ballads, even the slow songs in that era were like you take your Bic lighter and everybody sticks their arm up in the air, right?
Oh, no. Every ballad was sung to me.
I always wondered who it was.
Yeah, yeah. No, every ballad was sung to every girl in that audience. We all thought it was about us. And we thought that we would end up with one of the rockers. For me, it was always the drummer. But, you know, each to their own.
You know, you're probably better off that you didn't.
No, yeah. But I did marry a guy with long hair and a motorcycle.
That works
out.
Close enough, right? So it's got to be fun to evoke that era, especially since it was part of your life, right?
Yeah, it is. It's fun because the cast is actually, most of them were born in the 80s or 90s. And talking to them about what that was and what the experience was and how involved you got in it has been really, really interesting.
I bet.
We all have our own generation of music. A lot of us have followed bands, no matter when it is. And this has been a really interesting conversation to talk about what the excess was and the girls and boys outside the band buses when they showed up to a venue and people being drug off stage because of the excess they were doing. So it's been a really interesting conversation between all of us.
I would imagine. But it's kind of for you as the director to make sure that everything reaches that level of intensity. Everything is suitably exaggerated.
Yeah, it is. So it's how do you play it exaggerated in that sense, but real? So I'm like, if it's not real, it's not funny. And it's a comedy. So if it's not real, it doesn't work. If you're playing a caricature, it doesn't work instead of playing a character.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Because, well, in comedy, you can't act as if you're supposed to be funny, right?
Yeah.
You're supposed to take yourself seriously, and that's what makes it funny.
Right. The lines are funny in a lot of places. And it's backed up by all of this music that helped push that forward. And so how we work together to create characters instead of just trying to play the lines.
Yeah. Sounds like fun, Hannah.
Oh, it's so much fun.
I'm glad you came in with your Axl Rose bandana around your head.
Yeah, hey. It
somehow fits. You
got to dress up if you're going to promote a show.
Hey, that's what radio's all about. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Hannah Shawergali is the director of the Mono Valley Theater production of Rock of Ages. Opens Thursday and runs weekends until March 26th.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Does the Justice Department really have a case against former HPD chief Louis Kealoha and his wife? Well, it depends on who you talk to. Right now, we're going to talk to Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair to get an update on this ongoing reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Okay, so this all started with a stolen mailbox. Now we've got a federal investigation. How can we, on the outside, really know what kind of case the DOJ has against the Kealohas?
Well, we can't, because we're not privy to that information. There hasn't actually been a grand jury indictment. Our Nick Gruby tried to talk to the federal prosecutor. His name is Michael Wheat. He declined an interview, but he did speak to other people involved in the case, including Miles Briner. And as you know, he's the attorney for Louis and Catherine Kealoha. Quick, some context. Louis Kealoha is no longer the chief of police. His last day on the job was last month, forced out by the police commission. Catherine Kealoha is still working at the prosecutor's office, and it all centers on this mailbox, allegations that Gerard Puana was framed for stealing the Kealoha's mailbox, a case that actually unraveled. What Briner says, what he told Nick Gruby, was he thinks the Department of Justice really doesn't have a solid case. In fact, he even used the word farce. Remember, though, this is an investigation regarding corruption and abuse of power, and at least one person, one former cop, has already been convicted.
Okay, so on one hand, you'd expect the attorney for the Kealohas to say something like that, of course,
exactly,
to cast some doubt in there. On the other hand, because we really don't know what kind of case the feds have, we're kind of all in the same quandary.
Right. What Nick did is he looked at other federal prosecutions, including, do you remember Ted Stevens, the senator of Alaska, close friend with Dan Inouye?
Yes.
Back in 2009, there were felony counts against him. Stevens ended up losing his office, but it turned out later that they really didn't have the goods, and that was overturned. And so there's a prominent example involving a politician or a high-profile government official where the feds really just overreached. That said, Nick also talked to Puana's attorney. That's Alexander Silvert, and he was more cautious. He said, you know, we just don't know what the feds have before them. It could be that they actually have solid evidence. Yes, it's been 2 years now. Can you believe it? We've been talking about this for 2 years
now. Yes, I can.
But that doesn't necessarily reflect that maybe the case is not strong. Michael Wheat, Nick dug into his background, talked to a lot of people. He's got over 30 years of experience, and he has a record of winning a lot of high-profile cases. So we'll see whether he has the goods on the Kealohas or not.
Right, which kind of brings us back to the point that, you know, after talking about the Stevens case a moment ago and the fact that Michael Wheat has such experience, would he waste his time with something that he didn't feel was righteous enough to be able to move forward?
Yeah.
At this point, this is all conjecture, but we have to look and see. And now we're going to have to wait and see, too. Anyway.
Well, one thing's certain, Beth, and you and I are going to be talking about Louis and Catherine Kealoha in this and the mailbox case once again, or twice, or three times.
We keep saying that. And also, as this is a gridiron year, oh, my, I can imagine somebody in a mailbox pretty soon, Mr. Chad Blair.
That's insider baseball. Thank you, my friend.
That's the reality check for today. And if you missed that last part, it's simply because Chad Blair was in a mailbox in a skit for the last gridiron, or maybe even a couple of them. And we'll see what happens with the one coming up later this summer. Hawaii is woefully short of homes at all levels for the current and projected demand. You know that part, and you've known it for a long time. The need is especially acute at the affordable level. Affordable meaning what average or low-income buyers or renters can afford. And often, as we have talked about many times, that's a moving target. A 52-unit development is scheduled to be built on the Waianae Coast, and while the addition of 52 units is welcome, can they be made affordable, given the criticism of real estate analyst Ricky Cassaday, who has made the point that expensive, not affordable, should be the word applied to the Waianae Coast?
Well, what I've said about the Waianae Coast applies to the island as well as the state. The simple fact of economics is supply and demand. Limited supply. And what's happened since we've talked 15 years ago is that the internet has made it all that much more easier for people to want to live in Hawaii, visit Hawaii, enjoy the quality of life, and you just have that much more demand with that much less supply. Now, supply has generic problems. It starts with no land, but also the high cost of production, lack of labor, that sort of thing. And then right in between is an important component, which is your incomes, your local average incomes, your wages, your wealth, that sort of thing. And then the level of that has been growing at a rate that is less than the rate of price appreciation in housing or shelter. So as this has gone on over the generations, more and more people are less and less advantaged and less capable of attaining shelter.
So when we hear from Governor Ige that affordable housing has to be one of the cornerstones of our existence, is this in fact something where we can get not just ahead of the curve, but just start running at the curve?
Well, the impressive thing really is that the governor and the mayor and the legislature, they've all taken this to heart. And prior to this, the media was paying more and more attention over last year. You could see that coming out. And preceding that, of course, was a homeless problem. And so it's begun to snowball or it coalesce. And I will tell everybody that I should be very encouraged by what everybody at all levels of government is saying. The proof is in the pudding. Next question will be, well, can they achieve it? Which is, well, they need to coordinate themselves. They also need to lay aside some of their parochial prerogatives.
And what do you mean when you say parochial prerogatives?
Well, I mean, the city has a number of things that is vital to the provision of housing, such as sewer and roads and that sort of thing. The state actually has more money. It can raise money. State also has more land than the city does. And the golden opportunity in front of us is to take public land, city and state, state having more, and put affordable housing on it in a way that is that contributes positively to the society, not just in welfare, but also economically. I would like to see housing done by the public agencies, all of them state, federal, city, in a way that the private sector does it, which is simply to say, over 30 years, 50 years, the private sector has made money in real estate, in residential market. Why can't the public do the same thing in partnership with private business?
Senator Willis Sparrow has been asking that question, too. And this session was floating a bill that would float bonds to be able to make affordable housing happen. At this point, do you see where that is a viable strategy?
Oh, it's a key strategy if you address the key chokehold on housing, which is infrastructure. You can't put anything up if you don't have sewer capacity or water capacity. And one of the things that is a huge failure and it has put on the brakes for more housing across the board from affordable rental all the way up to luxury is, you know, the number of sewer hookups and how we process, you know, how we process our waste in our life and make this sustainable. And so I'm thrilled that a bond would do that because the concept would be you remove the stranglehold, the chokehold, and you allow more housing to be built. And almost all housing, except for public rental housing, is somewhat profitable across the board. At the very minimum, it gives us our property taxes. Of course, when you build the thing, you know, there's a lot of construction jobs and GET goes up. But in aftermath, you get property taxes and you get jobs and incomes that are tied to servicing already constructed buildings.
We talk about affordable housing. We use that term. But hearing things like, well, for a single person, you need to be making almost $100,000 to be able to afford a basic place in Hawaii, or for a family of four, maybe $140,000, $132,000, somewhere in there, that seems to be so out of reach for most people. Are we really talking affordable housing?
Well, no, you're absolutely right. I hear this over and over and over from children. They say, that's not affordable, Dad, and I have to agree with you. It's the way that the system works, though, that is important to at least grasp. Again, it's the fact that incomes, median incomes or otherwise, haven't risen as fast as property appreciation. So, again, the gap opens up. So what do you do? The classic and probably the tried and tested true way of achieving affordability in housing is to reduce the cost by taking money from somewhere else. Now, at the very low end of the affordability spectrum, public housing, you need a lot of money because not a lot of revenue is coming in. At the very top end of the housing ladder would be luxury, wherein you get a ton of money and you've built it for less, so therefore you have a profit margin. And so the historic thing ever since the 70s has been you get market units to cross-subsidize the affordable units. So it's a Robin Hood principle. And it has been working, except that as it went along, a gap opened up in between the two sides of housing, the high end and the low end. And the gap was what they call the workforce housing. These guys weren't advantaged in any way by that cross-subsidization of market to affordable. And so basically the hole opened up. The workforce isn't making enough money. And the way that the AMI structure is done, it's a fairly rigid structure, and it's full of rules, and you have to adhere to them. And basically the net of it is that there's no kind of give and take. And when there's no give and take in housing, since it's such an expensive proposition and risky. If it doesn't get built, it just doesn't get built, and the next generation suffers for that. And that's been going on for a long time.
How do you make it better?
Well, I would take what we have. You've got a couple really big consistencies. We have the best quality of life in the world, and people want to move here, and that's why we have demand. If you manage the demand in a way that it benefits all the people of Hawaii, particularly the ones that need support, that's my basic model. And then if you overlay that with transportation, the thing of the rail, you have all these rail stations, you have an opportunity to build affordable housing, high rises, and maybe mix it in with some market unit stuff so that basically you can build a lot of units. Let me say simply this. 1 in 5 families in the state needs public rental housing assistance. That's 20% of us. We have something like 5,000 to 10,000 public rental units, and we have a need of over 60,000. So, I mean, there's just a ton of people out there.
If we just look at this year, Willis Barrow's bill is still alive. It's with Ways and Means. Are you hopeful that this is going to be something that we'll see passed this year?
I don't believe the run-up. I've seen at the end of last session, Jill Takota, Ways and Means, and a couple other legislatures really made a push and did so in a way that I thought, they really get it. They're going to try. And even if, America's great on man on the moon goals, this is a man on the moon goal across the board, but something's going to come out of it and something productive. And there's enough common sense and simplicity in what they're attacking, the infrastructure, that sort of thing. And again, we've got to do the rail. That's kind of the headliner here. But I'd like to turn it around, and it's not TOD that's important, but DOT, which stands for Development-Oriented Transit. I always thought that Hawaii didn't need, on a big basis, a faster commute from outside in as much as they needed shelter. And the shelter thing has just grown and grown and grown. That's why I'm optimistic.
And on that note, I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Hawaii real estate analyst Ricky Cassaday is principal of Data at Work. He analyzes real estate market trends and produces project feasibility and long-range planning studies for developers, landowners, investors, and public housing agencies in Hawaii and Asia. We talked late last week.
Aloha, this is Will Shorts, Puzzle Master for NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our ridiculously tiny planet. And as usual, we turn to Christopher Phillips for his expertise on that and what we can look for in our dark island skies. Hey, Chris, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. For this week, stargazers, look out for the planet Venus located in the west after sunset. It is still very bright and easy to spot. Speaking of bright, the moon will be exactly that. It is approaching its full moon phase this week, so stargazing for faint objects will be a real challenge.
I understand something else that's kind of a real challenge you should have on the news pile this week, and that is a cosmic census.
It's super awesome. The folks at Subaru Observatory atop Mauna Kea have released a massive amount of data as part of a great cosmic census. It is called the Hyper Subprime CAM Subaru Strategic Program, and it is a large-scale survey of the universe. It records stars, galaxies, and other objects in one of the largest surveys of its kind.
These things always have such long names, huh?
Certainly a mouthful.
And in terms of survey, exactly how does this work?
Well, astronomical surveys use telescopes to collect data from the entire sky, night after night and year after year, in order to build up a picture of our universe.
And these were all optical images, meaning it was basically just like real camera images.
They are indeed. In fact, if you had eyes big enough, you could probably see the same things that Subaru picked out in the night sky, although your eyes would have to be pretty big.
And they were shot all at the Subaru telescope on Hawaii Island.
They were indeed.
And how big is the survey?
Well, it weighs in at a mighty 80 terabytes, and it took 300 nights of observing to produce. It's comparable to you and I taking 10 million pictures of the sky with our camera phones.
And then how do they use the data that they've generated?
Well, the sheer amount of science that is possible is mind-boggling. Astronomers can study black holes, galaxies, supernova, dark matter, and dark energy, and of course, the large-scale structure of the universe. Our listeners can see a sample of some of this beautiful work by visiting our website.
Just head to HawaiiPublicRadio.org to take a look at the material and an interesting stargazer from you this week. Thank you, Christopher.
You are welcome, Dave.
It's Christopher Phillips, and I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about a native seabird that breeds in the northwest Hawaiian Islands and on Oahu. It's able to make abrupt shifts in direction and speed in midair, a skill that makes it a formidable hunter, preying on small fish it catches by skimming along the ocean's surface or diving just below. Those fish are often driven to the surface by predators coming at them from below. The seabird is also skillful at catching flying fish in midair just above the surface. Its population in the Hawaiian archipelago is estimated about 15,000 breeding pairs, and we asked you the name of this indigenous seabird, which is the Manu'oku, or white tern.
And Mike Shapiro called us from Honolulu, knew the answer, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a Backyard Quiz question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
There's an ugly current that runs through American life, rough justice. In communities all over the country, people who spoke against the interests of those in power got lynched and more often than not escaped punishment. Katsu Goto was a first boat immigrant from Japan who spoke up for the rights of plantation laborers, and on the morning of October 29, 1889, his body was found hanging from a telephone pole near Honoka'a on Hawaii Island. His story had been buried by history until UH Hilo professor Patsy Iwasaki conducted the research that led to the making of the living history documentary film, Hono Ka'a Hiro, The Story of Katsu Goto. She's giving a talk this evening in Hilo, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning, Patsy.
Hi, good morning, Chris.
You know, first of all, we think of lynching as a product of the American South, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, I mean, it actually occurred here in Hawaii, where, you know, we think of as a paradise, and we talk about its diversity. But yes, there was a lynching that occurred in 1889.
And the victim, it was a guy who really seemed to be living the immigrant dream, right? He came here from Japan, one of the first arrivals, ended up as a successful storekeeper, and that's when he became a threat, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. He was trying to, gain a more professional career after his three-year labor contract on the sugar plantation, mm-hmm. and that did indeed become a threat.
To whom?
To the those in power at that time. It was a very small elite group, one of these the men that were in the trial, and he was convicted, was the store owner in Honoka, which was right next to Kotokatsu Goto's store.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also the poundmaster, the postmaster, and had several positions with the Kingdom of Hawaii government.
You know, given that, I mean, the way I understand the story, Patsy, there was a real effort to bring to justice the perpetrators.
Exactly. Rather than sweeping it under the rug, which would probably have been the case, the Japan had a vested interest in Hawaii at that time. Mm-hmm. In 1868, there was a immigration experiment, quote unquote, called the Gannen Mono, that did not end up too well. And so, for this contract labor agreement that occurred between the Kingdom of Hawaii and Japan, both governments had their hands in it a little bit more. And so that made it a little bit different. It was actual contract that the laborers had to sign.
So you would get passage to Hawaii in return for 3 years as an indentured laborer.
Yes, and then that was the government contract labor early on period. And then after a few years, it did fall into the hands of private companies. And I'm not as familiar with that labor agreement from that time, you know, when after the contract labor agreement period.
But, you know, the irony, sort of returning to the irony of Katsu Goto's story, is that he kind of did what an immigrant is supposed to do in Hawaii, in America, succeed.
Yes, he sure did, and he was a little bit unusual from the most of the laborers, because he did not come from the prefectures that we often hear about, such as Yamaguchi Prefecture, Hiroshima, Fukuoka. Mm-hmm. He came from Kanagawa Prefecture, which was in a town called Oiso, which was about 70 kilometers from Tokyo. And so he wasn't from the rural areas that most of the laborers came from. And he was also educated. He could read, write, and speak English.
Yeah.
And he was the firstborn son. He actually had to change his name from Katsu Kobayakawa to Katsu Goto. He was adopted in name only to be able to come to Hawaii. So that was a little unusual, too, for him to do that.
Well, the thing that's unusual also is that the fact that he was educated. So he came from he wasn't really labor, from a labor social class.
Well, from what we understand, his father and his family in Oiso were farmers, you know, probably rice farmers.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, he wasn't, the usual immigrant that we think of.
And it's certainly, reviewing his story just on the surface, it looks as if the way he gave offense really had to do with his speaking up for the rights of workers. That almost sounds as if that's when he had to go.
Well, you know, in the court documents that we've been able to find, and it's all in the archives, and we were able to look through them, the plantation owner was actually saying that the workers would often turn to Goto if there was something about the work schedule or anything mm-hmm. about the labor that they did not totally agree with. They would say that they were going to see Goto. And he had, you know, he was testifying about this, you know, in the trial. And so, yes, you know, he really did stand up for the workers. And basically, there was one night in October that Honakan plantation fields were caught on fire. And this plantation owner felt that Japanese workers were responsible for the fire and in connection Katsugoto.
You know, in another
that fire.
In another context, somebody like him might have been described as uppity.
That's true. He was trying to gain, you know, admittance into the plantation class. I mean, not plantation class, but I'm sorry, but professional class, you know, by becoming a store owner.
And the perpetrators were brought to trial and charged with, convicted of, what was it, second and third degree manslaughter?
Yes, they were. Not for murder, but for lesser manslaughter. That's right.
Which I guess was the best they could do at that time in that climate, sounds like.
Right. But only one served out his time in jail for 4 years. One of them was pardoned by President Sanford Dole, mm-hmm. who was the president of the Republic of Hawaii at that time. And the other two, one escaped to California and the other escaped to Australia.
Really, it's an ugly story, but the kind of story that needs to be kept alive, isn't it, Patsy?
Right. You know, the more I learn about Katsugoto, the more determined I am to share, you know, his story with others. And part of that is I was the first recipient of the Goto of Hiroshima Foundation grant established by Katsugoto's niece, Dr. Fumiko Kaya.
Well, Patsy, thanks very much for talking with us. It's really a valuable story, a valuable project. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Patsy Iwasaki is a professor of communications at Hilo. She and filmmaker Danny Miller will talk about the research and making of the film Honoka'a Hiro, the story of Katsugoto, tonight at 7 and tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. at the Lyman Museum in Hilo. And you can get the details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. With all the different activities going on throughout the state, Morning Edition host and our colleague, Derek Malama, joins us this time every day to look at events going on in our community that might just have gotten in under the radar. Today, Derek, you've got the Lanikai Mortgage Players, one of my favorite organizations.
Oh, really? Oh, yes.
Sure.
Yeah, they're holding auditions for their spring play, Blazing Guns at Roaring Gulch or the Perfumed Badge. The cast for this old-fashioned Western melodrama requires 5 men and 4 women. Yeah, it's
so
a story. Yeah,
you'd have a pretty good chance if you had a big handlebar mustache, for example. It sounds like.
Yeah, I think you would be good for that role.
I'm not sure if
not a handlebar. You don't have a handlebar, though.
Well, but you know, there's time, right?
Right. This is a story of a crusading young newspaper editor in Four Corners, Colorado. Dates for the play are the weekends of May 19th and May 26th, and auditions are at the Lanikai Community Center tomorrow from 7 to 8:30 p.m.
Time to get out there and be a thespian.
Yes.
And then we have people who've come back from the North Dakota pipeline demonstrations, yeah?
Yes, one of them, Daniel Kanahele, went to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in solidarity with protesters attempting to block the Dakota Access Pipeline. And this is the story of his encounters at Standing Rock. It's at 6:30 p.m. Tomorrow in the Kihei Public Library, and that's free.
And, you know, Derek, you'd never know it, but sandalwood was once big business in Hawaii, wasn't it?
Yes, the iliahi, or sandalwood trade, was really big in the early 19th century. It put the kingdom of Hawaii on the map. Although this led to the destruction of sandalwood forests, Paul Field is a history professor, or was a history professor, at Wynyard Community College, and he'll talk about how the sandalwood trade impacted relations between commoners and chiefs and led to the first official interference of the U.S. government in the affairs of the Hawaiian Kingdom. That's happening at the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium at 7 p.m. tomorrow, and that's free.
Many layers to that story, Derek.
Yes, I know.
Thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are under the radar. And you can always find out more about those and other events on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting Rock of Ages, a Broadway rock musical comedy set in 80s Hollywood, with music of Styx, Whitesnake, and more, opening this Thursday. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
Beth Ann, you know, whenever the subject of affordable housing is raised, you have to wonder, made by whom, lived in by whom? Who defines affordable, all those things. That all came up in your conversation today.
And that's the same conversation that I've been having with Ricky Cassaday for at least 15 or 20 years,
yeah.
As many of us have had with each other for just as long and longer. And although he says there seems to be confluence now that he hasn't seen before, and he's taking that as an optimistic point, I hope that comes to fruition.
It's not the easiest area to be optimistic about, is it?
Well, if you look, you know, back over your shoulder, no. But if you kind of look at some of the, you know, the tea leaves at the moment, it seems to be that there is a drive toward that, and we'll see if, in fact, that results in far more units than we have seen in past.
Well, there's a need. That's one thing that won't go away.
That's the truth. And we'll keep talking about how that need is going to be met. Now, tomorrow we're also going to talk about how the need to have communities that aren't violent is showing up in an upcoming forum. We'll talk with UH Associate Professor Dolores Foley, and Pulitzer Prize winning author Juno Diaz will be here.
And a new film looks at the Maori tradition of mourning at the Honolulu Biennial 2017.
You can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if you have something to tell us, or even better yet, you can call our talkback line. That's okay, too. Or you can call us, or rather, you can get to us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
Past shows are archived under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning, or see you tomorrow, with more of the conversation.